From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Rivals of the Ripper. Ooh, get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Nestle says it is voluntarily recalling a limited number of DiGiorno, Lean Cuisine, and Stouffer's products because of the possibility they might contain small pieces of glass. Boy, I hope I got your attention. The food giant said the source of the glass is in the spinach that is a common ingredient in all three brands. No injuries reported yet. The voluntary recall includes limited numbers of the DiGiorno pizzas, Lean Cuisine pizzas, and raviolis, and Stouffer's lasagnas and souffles. Okay, a little news you need to know. A pair of drugs can dramatically shrink and eliminate some breast cancers in just 11 days, according to doctors in the United Kingdom. This is quite a week for stories about cancer. They said the surprise findings reported at the European Breast Cancer Conference could mean some women no longer need chemotherapy. It's a great story. The drugs tested on 257 women targeted a specific weakness found in 1 in 10 breast cancers. Experts said the findings were a stepping stone to tailored cancer care. Unbelievable story here. The two top executives of the Wounded Warrior Project, among the largest veterans charities in the country, have been fired after an investigation into accusations of lavish spending on parties, hotels, and travel. Wounded Warrior Project CEO Stephen Nardizzi and COO Al Giordano were fired by the charity's board amid criticisms about how it spends more than $800 million raised in donations in the past 4 years. Danyon Brinkley, of course, noted author, struck by lightning three times, also heads up the Twilight Brigade, where he's been at the bedside of a number of soldiers. What's your take on this story, Danyon? It's kind of upsetting to me.
Well, it's heartbreaking, George. Most of us, and I'm a small organization, we're 7,000, and I can say less than 6% of our overall income goes to anything else other than training people and making sure they're at the bedside. But there has probably been 10 of these veterans organizations using Wounded Warriors that's done the same thing. The best thing that's coming out of this is, number one, the generosity of the American people to care about our veterans when we see what the VA is doing, when we see over 330,000 guys were put off to death. And now we're taking a good look at where our veterans are, and this raises the stakes. But these guys, we heard about these parties, a lot of the small organizations like ours, we heard about mm-hmm. this. And finally, somebody's taken a look at these kinds of organizations. And you know what, George, I can tell you this. When they dig in deep, when they start digging in deep,
there's more.
That 50, that you're going to see unbelievable amount of waste. You know, look at the top paid person at Red Cross and look at United Way. I mean, if you start looking at across the board what their expenditures are equal to what their support per dollar that goes to the person, to the people they're supposed to help, it's really hard to believe the generosity of the American people and then the people we put in charge, especially about people who created the opportunity to keep us safe. I see and listen to Wounded Warriors. I see them all the time, and I listen, so for everybody that's out there, take a good look at the organization that you're going to donate to. Really care about us and our veterans, but really take a good look. Don't listen to a good commercial, because you'll see that a good 50 to 60% of them are in the same place as Wounded Warriors. But this money was coming in so fast, George, and coming in so quickly, that a lot of times it just goes to the head. And I'll bet you this guy's never spent any time around Wounded Warriors.
Probably not.
And, you know, they don't spend any time around them. They don't really see the urgency and the need of what we're going through. And Wounded Warriors are broader than people who lost limbs, PTSD, and traumatic brain injury, and internal damage, and then the families who all of a sudden have to start over, parents who have to become parents again with 25-year-olds, wives with two children, now has a third or a fourth child based on this. And this is downright evil, George.
Well, I'm glad, Daniel, you're doing what you're doing, and we'll continue reporting on stories like this, but disgusting, isn't it? Just disgusting. Two U.S. soldiers serving in South America have contracted the Zika virus, but they are fully recovered now and they return to duty, while a third, a pregnant service member, left the region early for fear of contracting that virus as well. North Korea responded to new sanctions from South Korea by firing short-range ballistic missiles into the sea in a show of defiance and vowing to liquidate all remaining South Korean assets at former cooperative projects that are in the north. Now, the moves are the latest in an escalating standoff between the Koreas that began in January when North Korea detonated what it said was the H-bomb of justice. So much is going on in the world, I thought we'd check in with Howard Bloom and let him just tell us what he thinks about all this stuff. It's madness, Howard.
Well, what I've been focusing on is the astonishing election campaign, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, and the conclusion that really we owe Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders a vote of thanks, and here's why.
Okay.
Donald Trump is speaking for a side of our soul that we do not know, and so is Bernie Sanders. For 50 years, in my opinion, we've been sold big lies by both the Republicans and the Democrats, and we are hungry, hungry for what feels like truth. The big lies of the Republicans have been these, that we should not tax the rich. We should not regulate the safety of corporations. We do not need an infrastructure. We do not need roads. We don't need bridges, the internet. We don't need basic research on health. We don't need any of the things the government has given to our lives. And we don't need government. All we need are cars, guns, religion, and a big overpriced military. And the big lies of the Democrats are that corporations are all evil, that capitalism is monstrous, that all the world's problems are our fault, that we are the most violent civilization in the history of mankind, and that if we just apologize to everyone and stop policing the world, if we just stop polluting the place and torturing animals, we will have peace and a Garden of Eden. What we've been sold by both the Republicans and the Democrats has proven false. The Republicans' lies gave us the Great Recession of 2008. The Democrats' lies gave us 9/11, ISIS, and the Paris massacres. And the truth, here's the trick, George, the truth is in between. It's a balance between the two. We need both government and corporations. We need both an infrastructure and we need entrepreneurs. We also need one more thing. We need the protest industry. We need the squeaky wheel. We need the professional complainers who show us our errors and get us to correct our ways. We need a vigorous press. But the bottom line is that we are starving for truth. And sometimes Donald Trump, the clown who never checks his facts, hits a truth on the head. And sometimes Bernie Sanders, the socialist who doesn't even belong to a party, gets a truth right too, which means that we need more than just one voice to help us figure out what is true and what is false. Sometimes we need unconventional voices to show us the way, and Bernie and Trump have shredded our political conventions and seemingly tossed them away, and frankly, we owe both of them our thanks.
Get ready for Tuesday next week, Howard. We're going to call on you. Another major series of primary elections. We'll see what happens. A capital murder suspect who busted out of jail in Mississippi last week tied up a family at a home in Vicksburg before one of the homeowners broke loose and killed the intruder. Police said that the unnamed homeowner shot the man in the head. The entire encounter lasted roughly 3 hours. Laws requiring background checks for buyers of guns and ammunition, as well as requirements that firearms be traceable, could sharply reduce gun deaths in the United States, according to a new study there. And how about this? We could be living on the moon in 10 years or less, and it wouldn't be that expensive, thanks to robots, 3D printing, and SpaceX. Let's check in with our science advisor and space historian, Robert Zimmerman. 10 years or less, Robert?
Let's put it this way, George. SpaceX didn't exist a decade ago. None of their rockets existed. and in less than a decade, they now dominate the entire launch industry, and they've forced everybody to figure out how to do things cheaper because they are cheaper than everybody else. So can it be done in a decade? I think it can, but the way to do it will be competition between many different companies independently working to try to cut costs and make it cheaper. The part of this story, too, is that going to the moon makes sense. As NASA astrobiologist Chris McKay says, the moon is as dull as a ball of concrete, but we're not going to get to Mars until we can learn how to do it on the moon first. And that's why you want to go to the moon first. It's close, it's easy, relatively easy, mm-hmm. and it gives you that opportunity. And so, I think 10 years, we're going to start. I think we're going to have people back on the moon easily within that time.
All right. That's going to be fun to watch. Robert, thank you so much. The Department of Justice is expected to announce charges against up to 5 Iranians believed to have been tied to the 2013 hacking of a New York dam. The Department of Justice expected to make the announcement sometime in the coming days. The individuals are believed to have connections with the Iranian government. The hackers infiltrated the control system of the Bowman Avenue Dam in Rye Brook, New York, which is about 20 miles outside of New York City. The Wall Street Journal reports at the time that the breach raised fears of vulnerabilities of the United States' infrastructure to foreign hackers. It also came at a time when the Iranians were on the offensive, attacking U.S. banks. Up next, Dark Territory, the secret history of cyber war. Get ready for this story with Fred Kaplan next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you about our guest. Fred Kaplan is the author of Dark Territory, the secret history of cyber war, and 4 other books. He's also the war stories columnist for Slate.com, former Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the Boston Globe, and in his last book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot That Changed the American Way of War, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's got a PhD from MIT, lives in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm pleased to have him on our program. Hello, Fred. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Man, we have been talking about protecting the power grid because of the possibility of cyber attacks. You go way back. You go back before even knew we had cyber potentials for war.
Right. Well, you know, this is a topic that's in the newspapers all the time now, but people think that it started maybe 5 years ago. It goes back to the dawn of the internet itself. Back in 50 years ago, they were about to roll out something called the ARPANET, which was the precursor to the internet. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that, you know, all the Defense Department's contractors, scientists in labs and universities around the country, instead of using separate consoles, they could all plug into one network and they could talk with each other, and it would be a boon to scientific research. It was a great idea. But there was a computer scientist at the RAND Corporation named Willis Ware, and he was a computer pioneer back in the days when there weren't very many of these people, and he was also on the scientific advisory board to the National Security Agency. And he wrote a paper. It's very interesting. It was classified at the time. It's been declassified since. And he said, look, the problem is that when you create a network, when you have access to information online from remote, multiple, unsecured locations, you are creating inherent vulnerabilities. You're not going to be able to keep secrets anymore. Now, when I was doing research for this book, I went and talked with a man who was the head of the project at the time, the head of the ARPANET project. And I said, did you read Willis Ware's paper? And he goes, oh, yeah, sure, I knew Willis. And I said, well, what'd you think? And he said, well, I took it to the team and asked them what they thought. And they said, oh, God, don't saddle us with a security requirement. Look how hard it was to do what we've done. It would be like asking the Wright brothers, you know, demanding that the first airplane carry 20 people 50 miles. Let's take this one step at a time. The Russians, it's going to take them decades before they can do something like this. And it did. It took 2.5-3 decades. But by that time, whole systems and networks had sprouted up with no provision for security whatsoever. And I see this as sort of, you know, the bitten apple in the digital yeah. Garden of Eden. This is where it all started, and everything that we read about now is a logical consequence of that decision to ignore this one scientist's advice because it was just too hard to do.
And I would guess a lot of people during that era, Fred, probably didn't even understand the scope and magnitude of this.
No, nobody knew what a computer was. I mean, 1967, think back. No, it was a mystical kind of thing. It was something magical. Nobody knew that we would come to a time like we are in now where practically everything is plugged into a computer. I mean, you know, this dam that you mentioned in the news that hackers...
Yeah, the possible Iranian connection.
Now, how does that work? They don't hack into the dam. You know, it's a physical... What they do... the thing that controls the flow of water in and out of a dam is a computer.
Is the computer, the brain.
Right, and that controls the flow of water and lifts the gauges and so forth. What you do, you hack into that computer, and you can manipulate how much water is going in and out. You can flood the zone. You can dry up the water supply. That's the danger. And what happened was that in the last 25 years, all of our critical infrastructure, by which I mean banking and finance, transportation, electrical power, water supply, you know, things like that, everything was plugged into this kind of network. Why? Well, it makes things cheaper. It's easier to control. You don't have human error. You don't have human costs. It's a natural. It's irresistible. In the early 90s, when people in the government were beginning to realize the vulnerabilities of this, there was a commission. And the commissioners would call forth, you know, that the head of various big utility companies and so forth, and they would talk about how they were putting everything online because it's more efficient. And the commissioners would ask, now, what are you doing about the security? And they would say, what do you
security?
Mean? they didn't know that, you know, nobody had heard of hackers back in the early 90s, unless there were a few movies that you watched. But no, nobody thought it was real. This was science fiction. And now everything is vulnerable because of this decision. And, you know, here's the funny thing. You know, I know a lot of your listeners are suspicious of the government, and rightly so.
Yes.
But there were people in the White House at various times who wanted to impose mandatory security requirements on critical infrastructure, which, you know, in this country is owned by private corporations. But, you know, it's a national asset. And this was always resisted by lobbyists, by the corporations themselves, and by... you know, Treasury secretaries, Commerce secretaries, economic advisors in the White House who said, no, this is going to impede innovation. To put more security barriers, it also makes, you know, you slow down the speed. It's going to make these companies less competitive in the foreign marketplace. And so this was always resisted. And we are in the situation we are in today because of that.
Fred, do you think when the two Steves, Jobs and Wozniak, were putting together their smaller computers for major retail sales, they even thought about hacking?
Well, there have always been hackers. You know, back in the 60s, they weren't hackers. They were people who could figure out...
they were smart.
the phones... You know, you could go beep, 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 and you could use long-distance phone calls for free.
That's right.
Messed around with phone beeps. Then when computers came along, I mean, you know, the movie War Games was in 1983. The movie Sneakers was in 92. These were all about hackers. This whole community of hackers kind of grew up, and some of them, you know, they had kind of competitions of who could break into secure networks more than the other guy or faster than the other guy. And you know, some of these people later went on to become, you know, people who worked in the NSA or consultants or people who were guard against security. And some of them stayed mischief makers. But what became, what started out as kind of an anarchic culture, and I write about some of these people in the book who later had tremendous impact on actual policy, is now, you know, embodied in one of the most secretive intelligence agencies in the United States.
Let's talk more about this, Fred. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back. Fred Kaplan, our special guest for the next couple hours. Dark Territory is the name of his book. His website already linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Make sure you spend some time going to our website and just peruse all the guests and their incredible material. And welcome back to Coast. Fred Kaplan with us. His book, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Didn't Fred Ronald Reagan see War Games, and he was fascinated by the movie, did not know about the possibility of hacking, and he asked one of his generals if that was possible?
Right. This is one of the most startling stories that I found in the course of my research, and it's what starts the book. In the first weekend of June 1983, President Reagan is up at Camp David. He's watching movies every night. You know, he watched a lot of movies.
He's a movie star. He likes movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think President Clinton even watched more movies. But anyway, Reagan, the Saturday night of this weekend, he watches War Games. You might remember that was the movie with Matthew Broderick as a teenage whiz kid who unwittingly hacks into the computer of the North American Air Defense Command, and thinking that he's kind of glommed onto a new online game called Global Nuclear War, just about sets off World War III. So the following Wednesday, there's a meeting in the White House with Reagan and his national security advisors, and they're not talking about this. They're talking about something else. But this movie, he still has this movie on his mind, and at one point he puts down his index cards, and he says, has anybody seen this movie War Games? Okay, nobody had it. It had just come out. So he launches into this very detailed plot description. And, you know, people are kind of looking around like, where's this going? What's this all about? And he turns to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Vesey, and says, General, could something like this really happen? And the general says, I'll look into that, Mr. President.
He had no idea at that time, right?
So he comes back a week later, and he says, Mr. President, the problem is much worse than you think.
Wow.
And this led, over the next 10 months, to the first presidential directive on communications and computer security. And the language of this directive read a lot like things you read today. You know, computer systems, which were just then coming into being, are very vulnerable to electronic interference. Could be done by foreign intelligence, by criminals, by terrorists. But then it took a little twist. This directive was really written by the National Security Agency, which is where all the people who knew anything about this stuff hung out. And they wrote the directive so that they would control the standards for all computers in the United States. Now, the NSA, you know, their charters for foreign intelligence. So a lot of people on Capitol Hill didn't like this at all. And they changed it. But the point is, in that weird moment, the whole debate that we're seeing in full flux now got started about the vulnerability of our systems, the tensions between civil liberties and security, the rivalries between the NSA and other departments of government. It all stems from this weird weekend when Ronald Reagan watched War Games, and then a few days later asked a question that made everybody in the room, their eyeballs were rolling, like, oh, Jesus, there goes the old man again, you know? And yet this led to was the first time that the kinds of concerns that Willis Ware was talking about 15 years earlier finally floated up to the top of U.S. government.
These cyber attackers, Fred, what are they trying to do? Just disrupt us? Or is it a prelude to a attack of weaponry? What are they trying to do?
Well, different hackers have different motives, but there's one thing that you need to keep in mind, and this was a turning point in my own research. I was talking with someone very senior in the intelligence community, and I was going over a declassified report from the early 90s, which talked about our vulnerabilities and the different scenarios that could lead to a serious attack. And he said, and this was somebody who had helped to write this report, and he said, look, here's the thing you have to keep in mind. We have been doing this to other countries for a long time. getting into their networks, hacking their stuff. And at some point, somebody, it occurs to them, a light bulb goes out, and they think, oh, wait a minute. What we can do to them, they can someday do to us. You know, this
That's
isn't the
right.
Manhattan Project. You don't need a campus of great physicists building an atomic bomb. You need a room of computers and some really smart people who know how to use them. And as the World Wide Web becomes the World Wide Web, a lot of people can do this all over the world. And the dangerous thing is, okay, we're a lot better at this than a lot of other countries, but we're also hooked up to the network more than a lot of countries, more than any other country, our military, our society, our critical infrastructure. And so, for example, we have better rocks that we can throw at other houses, but we live in a much glassier house. So a country that maybe might not be as good at us as us at doing this sort of thing can still do quite a lot of damage. Now, you ask, what are they after? The same thing that we're after. I mean, when we get into inside, say, China's critical infrastructure,
and we're doing that, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, or the military command system or whatever. And they're inside ours, too. Now, this can be looked at as two ways. On the one hand, you know, what's the best way to see whether somebody's about to attack us? Well, you get in their network. You prowl around. It's like having a spy in their government, but you've got a digital spy in their networks. And they do the same to us. And maybe the motive is simply what they used to call active defense. We want to know when they're about to attack us. But actually going ahead and attacking, it's just one more step. Otherwise, it's the same technology. It's the same skill sets. It's the same people doing it. And we're already inside. We're inside their stuff. They're inside our stuff. If tensions build, if a crisis seems looming, if a confrontation seems looming, there's tremendous incentive on both sides to go first, to knock out the other guy's communications and therefore make it harder for him to fight a war. And again, it's one of these things, we've seen this in various parts of human history, where people are doing things for what they may quite rationally see as defensive motives.
Right.
And yet, it accelerates the pace and the juggernaut toward preemptive offensive action.
Well, there's no question in my mind that if this there's going to be a prelude to a real war, then they're going to soften us up with cyber attacks.
Or we'll soften them up.
Or we'll do the same.
Too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is kind of an interesting thing. I learned this fact after I did my book. So, you know, this is like bonus material to the DVD, you know. The Navy is now teaching its navigators on ships how to use the sextant to navigate by the stars.
In case everything goes, right?
Because in case the data links to GPS satellites are hacked into. Now that kind of, you know, our whole qualitative edge in military force is built around things that are plugged into computer
networks.
Right.
Well, they're assuming the ships are going to be able to run.
Yeah, right. Well, they'll run, but will they know where they're going? Will the precision weapons actually land with precision? It's all guided by GPS and other things that, again, are plugged into computer networks. You know, one thing, we mentioned war games. The interesting story is that the guys who were writing that script, they wondered about the plausibility of one of it. Could a kid from the outside
stumble, right?
Could he hack into the phone network of NORAD's computers? And one of them lived in Santa Monica, and he called the RAND Corporation, which was in Santa Monica, and they said, who can I talk to about this? And they recommended him to this guy, Willis Ware, right? The guy who invented the notion that these things were vulnerable.
Yeah.
And Willis was a very friendly guy, and he said, oh, you know, it's a funny thing. I designed the software for that computer in real life. And he said, yeah, you know, you're right. It is a closed system, but there's always some officer who wants to work from home on the weekend, so they leave open a port so that he can get in. And yeah, I guess.
And he's telling him this?
Yeah, if you dialed the number, yeah, you could get in. And then he said, you know, here's what a lot of people don't understand. And he said this in 1983. He said, the only computer that's completely secure is a computer that no one can use.
The Ukraine was hacked. Its power grid was hacked when somebody dropped in a virus via email, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is an interesting issue, and this hasn't come out so much. Why did that happen? Were the Russians just messing with the Ukrainians? Well, in part, yes. But also, it was retaliation. The Ukrainians had cut off power to Crimea. You know, Crimea has been part of Ukraine for 60 years. So guess what? A lot of their power supplies run through Ukraine. So the Ukrainian government cut off supplies. You know, they just turned it off the switch.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Russians hit back, but they hit back with a cyber attack because the Ukrainian electrical grid is actually very poorly secured, and it was pretty easy. But yeah, that they can do that to Ukraine. When the Russians invaded Georgia several years back, at the same time that they moved in planes and tanks, they also launched a cyber attack on all of the Georgian military and the ministries so that the commanders couldn't talk with their soldiers, so their diplomats couldn't alert other countries. And, you know, we've done this too. I mean, the classic case being Stuxnet. There was the Iranians were working on what seemed to be a nuclear weapon. So the NSA and the Israelis designed this incredible worm that hacked into, again, not the nuclear plant itself, but the computer server that was controlling the speed with which centrifuges were spinning, you know, the little paddles which enrich uranium, and they could control that. Once you're into a network, you know, when you're tapping a phone line, you're listening to a phone. When you're setting up a listening station, you're listening to radio signals. When you hack into a network, you can get into the network and mess with it. You can shut it down. You can manipulate it. So they got into the network, and then they also got into the monitoring system. There are people monitoring this, and it looked to them like everything was normal.
Yeah.
Everything was turning at the right speed. This was a very elaborate operation. And it set back the Iranian nuclear program by about 3 years. It destroyed about half of the centrifuges that were online at the time. Again, I mean, this is going on in more fields. I mean, in my book, I talk about cyber operations that were conducted during the Iraq War,
mm-hmm.
during the first Gulf War.
Very efficient, too.
During the air operations against Milosevic in Serbia. In really all the major conflict and minor conflicts that we've been involved in the last 30 years, we have been exploiting these kinds of vulnerabilities just as much as some of the other major powers have been.
Most of our fighter jets are running on computers now. Most mm-hmm. civilian aircraft run on computers now.
That's right.
What about hacking into them while they're still flying?
It's a little harder. You know, they're moving very fast. It's not like there's a stationary thing. There are precautions. You know, that's one thing that air traffic control does but it's a danger, and people are worried about it. Now, let me tell you what someone told me, and this isn't in the book either. It was something that I learned after the fact. Maybe I'll put all this in the paperback edition. But there was a drill once. Some airlines hired a contractor to see how vulnerable they were. And the contractor pulled a fast one. Instead of looking at the vulnerability of the airplanes, which did have some measures and you'd have to hack through and it was really difficult,
mm-hmm.
what they did was shut down all the vendors and suppliers in the airport. You know, the guys handling baggage, the companies handling
food. Yeah.
The ticket counters, you know, the people who are arranging seats. And by doing that, which was completely wide open, totally vulnerable, they in effect shut down all the airlines.
Well, didn't one of the airlines several months ago have a problem with its boarding passes? and they couldn't get them fast enough.
It's unclear what was going on there, but
they could have been hacked.
Maybe it's quite possible. I'll give you an example. That there was a commission during the Clinton administration. It was the first commission that looked into this sort of thing, and you know, when I was interviewing people, I often asked them what their aha moment was in all of this. And one of the chief guys on the commission, his aha moment was they were flying from Washington to Boston. They were going to take an 8 a.m. plane for a 10:30 hearing to talk with people about some vulnerabilities in infrastructure. The plane couldn't take off because the computerized weights and balances system had broken down.
Oh.
I mean, it wasn't hacked, but it just broke down. The computer crashed. And nobody knows how to use a slide rule anymore. That's how they used to do it. And so the
I do.
Yeah, right.
I used to make my baseball averages.
Yes. I learned a long time ago, but I've forgotten. But anyway, that was his aha moment. He goes, here I am, waiting to board an airplane to go have a hearing on how vulnerable our economy is, and I can't make the hearing because of how vulnerable our economy is.
Yeah, exact. Poetic.
Yeah.
It would seem to me, initially, that these hackers are testing something.
Because
they're doing these in, you know, small, sporadic areas, the dam in New York, a power system here. They're not doing anything widespread. I think it's a test, Fred. I think it's to see how they can get in, how vulnerable, and then they're going to go for the gusto.
Well, you know, one thing, the gusto is limited to some degree. You know, we do have a kind of a decentralized, federated system. That there's no one switch where you could turn off all the lights in America. You know what I mean? That there is expanded, and you know, every once in a while you probably get in the mail something, you know, join the smart grid, you know, get your power from Boston because it's cheaper there. And it is expanding. And there probably is some kind of switch they could pull, and it would shut down several cities or maybe a region, but not the whole country. And, you know, it's much less centralized than, say, a country like Japan, for instance, or, you know, in a place like Beijing, there are only a few cities where if you shut them down, you could really turn off government. You could turn off all kinds of things. We're a little bit more spread out, so I don't think you could submit the whole country to starvation or something.
Well, an EMP attack would,
you could
do
a lot of damage. You could definitely, and you know, every once in a while, the military, which is the most heavily secured part of our infrastructure, they occasionally have a war game where, you know, some hackers from the NSA usually see if they can break into the command control network.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
it's a game. They turn them loose, right?
Yeah, right. They always get in.
They do?
They always get in. Sometimes using commercially available equipment and software. And in fact, there was a Defense Science Board report in the Pentagon a few years ago about cyber war. And these guys concluded, they talked about the inherent fragility of our architecture. The inherent, again, this goes back to Willis Ware, you know, 1967. And what the Pentagon is focusing on now, and a lot of industries who are aware of, that are aware of this are focusing on now as well. I mean, you know, they still try to make the lock tighter, but what they're really focusing on is detection and resilience. You know, to make sure that if somebody does break in, they notice it right away, and they can repel them right away and repair and recover from any damage done.
But would you know who's doing it?
It's harder. I mean, you know, if somebody launches a ballistic missile at you, you can trace the arc of that missile. You can see exactly where it came from.
Well, unless it's from a ship.
You could know that it's coming from that ship.
But you don't know who owns the ship. But hold on, Fred. We're at the break. You've opened up a new discussion here. We'll get right into that when we come back.